Hello, this is Dave Emery, and this is Side 2 of For the Record Program number 564, Interview with John Loftus, subtitled He Who Tells the Truth Gets Chased Out of Nine Villages. This has been recorded on August 13th of the year 2006, and once again, it is my privilege and honor to present John Loftus, author of, among other titles, The Ballara Secret, Secret War Against the Jews and Unholy Trinity, and a longtime investigator. John, welcome back once again to our airwaves.
Well, thank you, Dave.
Now, we were talking about the Webb-Palmerine Act and an early manifestation of globalization and how American and also British transnational corporations reinvested their capital in Germany and other places, and how this had a lot to do with World War II. In For the Record 560, for veteran listeners who'd like to go to the web, I talked about an article that was in Newsweek. And it mentioned that the economic agenda of the fascist, well, they didn't call them fascist, but of Muslim Brotherhood, was consistent with the economic agenda of the multinational corporations. And specifically, they cited, among others, Ibn Khaldun, the Muslim Brotherhood's economic mentor from like the 14th century, or their role model, and the World Bank. And no less an authority than the World Bank said that he was the first advocate of privatization. There's been obviously we're at war with groups like Muslim Brotherhood or with like Al-Qaeda and other Muslim Brotherhood offshoots, and yet there seems to be a present-day duplicity towards the Muslim Brotherhood on the part of some significant interests. Do you think that am I perhaps reading too much into it or forcing an analogy when I see something of a parallel between the multinationals' attitude towards the Brotherhood and their attitude towards European fascism of the World War II period?
No, I think it's a fair and accurate analogy. There's more than a sort of a literary confluence here. There's some historical groundings. People don't realize that when the Arab Nazis were relocated to Saudi Arabia, and it was part of the Cold War stuff. The Russians had their Arab communists, we had our Arab Nazis, and these were proxy armies that fought it out. And every once in a while, we'd take the Arab Nazis out of the closet and turn them loose. The last time we did that was in Afghanistan in the early 80s. The Muslim Brotherhood, the last of the World War II Arab Nazis were still in charge, then guys like Azam. And the new generation of Nazis, the second generation of Nazis, if you will, the Osama bin Laden's guys, came up, and they didn't call themselves a Nazi movement, they called themselves Al-Qaeda, the base, the right-wing base, is what Al-Qaeda means. It's from the rosters of the Mujahideen that came in and fought in Afghanistan. And the right-wing half of that, the people who are most, if you will, ideologically committed to the ideals of Hitler, of fascism, became the guys who were the Islamic wing of the old Nazi army, just reborn. So, you know, World War II isn't over, guys. We're still fighting it because we let the Arab Nazis go. And just as there were American corporations and British corporations and others that supported Hitler financially in the days before World War II, there were a lot of Western corporations that have supported Osama bin Laden and the Taliban because they thought there might be oil advantages in it for them. Strange world, but the more things change, the more they stay the same.
John, you are yourself a former military officer, and I'm wondering if you have any observations you'd like to share with us simply about the military course of the conflict in Lebanon.
You know, a lot of my friends in the left, and I try and be patient, I have friends on the right, friends on the left, I'm pretty much a centrist. My friends on the left are often anti-Israel, because that's what they've heard from, you know, the French intellectuals in the 60s and 70s, and there's a whole genre of this stuff. And it's just bad news, and it's just wrong. But, you know, things change. People that declared the Hezbollah a terrorist organization worldwide are now up against some of the far-left groups that say, Hezbollah's are, liberators, freedom fighters trying to, downplay the hated Israelis.
Freedom fighters who use the Nazi salute.
Yeah. And what's funny is that, for 6 years, Israel, after it withdrew from Lebanon, they kept the peace, despite a lot of Hezbollah provocations, shooting rockets over the border. Nothing was done until, a month ago when Hezbollah sent 64 rockets over the border, came and killed five Israelis and kidnapped two. So Hezbollah started the war, but they did it on orders from Iran. Iran, over the last 6 years during the peace, has been rebuilding these huge underground bunkers, storing the latest anti-tank missile systems, transforming Hezbollah from a terrorist group until up to the special forces wing of the Iranian army, the Iranian Republican Guard Corps. Hezbollah, their officers go to school in Iran, are trained in Iranian officer schools. The commands are given in Farsi, the Iranian language, not in Arabic, their native language. Iran has bought Hezbollah.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Hezbollah has been on the defensive because the Israelis came roaring back. They started off very slowly. Hezbollah had about 13,000 rockets. They're probably down to about 2,000 or 3,000 now, about another month's supply firing at this rate. They start off with about 3,000 professional soldiers. They're down to about 1,200 at this point. They've had about a two-thirds attrition. Hezbollah is in a bad case. If this keeps going like this for the next 30 days, Hezbollah in South Lebanon will be extinguished. Now, the Arab world wants Hezbollah to be crushed as a lesson to Iran to stay in its own backyard. They don't want to let Hitler loose. They don't want to give him any encouragement. But being Arabs, they have to have some cover for it. So the cover is that the U.S. and France got together and came out with a peace plan draft that was 100% pro-Israel. And, of course, the Arab world came back screaming in anger and gnashing their teeth. And so we compromised with a plan that was 70% pro-Israel. And the Arabs shrugged their shoulders and said, okay. So Israel said, yep, we'll keep the peace. We agree. Hezbollah at first said, we'll keep the peace. And then Hezbollah read the fine print. Hezbollah had been set up. This peace plan called for Hezbollah to essentially move out of southern Lebanon entirely, to surrender all their weapons, and to forbid resupply by any countries outside Iran. No weapons may be shipped to Lebanon except to the UN group and the Lebanese army. Most importantly of all, 15,000 people from the Lebanese army and 15,000 from the UN would arrive in Lebanon to control the southern border. This was the Hezbollah stronghold. And Hezbollah has about 1,000 remaining, say 2,000 or 3,000 in reserve, 30,000 troops, even though, you know, some of the Lebanese are still, you know, that would be the death knell. So all of a sudden, Hezbollah has reversed themselves. Nasrallah, who, by the way, is hiding in the sub-basement of the Iranian embassy in Beirut.
Mm-hmm.
Nasrallah has said, no, we're going to stay fighting until the last Israeli troop is out of Lebanon. Well, that's a violation of the peace plan. He's contradicted himself. The peace plan called for a phased Israeli withdrawal to be replaced by the Lebanese army. So Hezbollah is saying, we're going to keep shooting. There's no ceasefire. So Hezbollah has intentionally wrecked the peace plan. And indeed, the fighting going on today is among the heaviest it's ever been.
Yeah, well, it certainly has been. Do you have any thoughts about the actual Israeli military conduct of the campaign?
Yeah, the Israelis were really surprised that Iran had given Hezbollah so many very advanced anti-tank missiles, that Hezbollah had sent North Korean tunnel builders in to build fortified redoubts. A very sophisticated plan. And the Israelis were, you know, instead of, they tried to do their door-to-door stuff to cut down on, you know, humanitarian casualties and not do carpet bombing. The Israelis don't do carpet bombing at all. But what's happened is the Israelis ran into this trap that Iran had set, that they'd come into a village and the Hezbollah would run away and the Israelis would go through the village. Next thing there was, you know, two or three underground redoubts would erupt with guys at their back firing anti-tank missiles. So Israeli casualties were high. The Israeli tanks were just, they've lost, more than 50, almost 60 tanks now. That's an entire tank brigade, if you put them together. So tank warfare, I think, is all over. That these new anti-tank missiles are just simply too sophisticated to take on. So Israel has gotten through the worst of it, this big change in tactics and weaponry, and they're doing what Israel does best. They've taken the high ground. And they are bombing the launch sites of the rockets. They'll probably have, you know, Hezbollah pretty much wiped out south of the Litani River within the next 30 days. And I think it's going to, I've always said it, from day one, this would be a war that would last 10 or 12 weeks. So the Israelis would need that much time to get Hezbollah out of firing range.
One of the difficult things to navigate is the media coverage of this entire situation. For example, the Jerusalem Post talks about the coming peace agreement as a disaster, and there's also been a lot of criticism of the Israeli general staff for relying too much on air power. I guess the equivalent of the Joint Chiefs of Staff is a former Air Force general. And here in the Bay Area, where the general tone has been hysterical with a capital H. It's just an extremely anti-Israeli. I say, slight editorialization, if the advocates of the hidden imam, if one of the signs of the end times for them is that barking dogs are going to start to talk, that's happening in the Bay Area. in a lot of the anti-Israel crowd, it's definitely happening here. So who knows? Maybe they're right. The media. One of the things that I've noticed about the media coverage, though, it has been unbalanced, and actually have been a number of people who've noted that the latest distortions in terms of civilian casualties, and certainly I don't want to be misunderstood saying there haven't been or that those aren't regrettable, but it's war and it's hell. But there's a huge, huge distortion, including outright, not only exaggeration, but outright fabrication of civilian casualties.
Yeah. It's the saddest thing is I strongly support the right of my friends in both the left and right to voice their opinions about war. None of us know the whole truth here. It is important to listen to both sides with respect. It is not allowable to forge evidence. It is not allowable to alter photographs. It is not allowable to stage events. And that's what's been going on. The village of Kana, there was an Israeli raid at 1 o'clock. They saw an armored rocket launcher pull into a garage next door to what they thought was a vacant building. And they bombed that garage at 1 o'clock. 7 hours later, the vacant building next door collapsed. And then the word spread, there's 60 people buried there, majority children. That was a complete lie. At most, we have 28 names, not bodies, names of people who might have been in the building. It appears that this might also have been an ammo dump for Hezbollah. There's even some talk that Hezbollah might have detonated because it's very unusual for a building to fall 7 hours afterwards. But that's all debatable. You know, reasonable people can disagree with that. What's not debatable is that some of the corpses that showed up had severe rigor mortis consistent with death 24 hours earlier. In other words, the Israelis couldn't possibly have killed them.
There's a guy, I've nicknamed him Mort the Mortician, who is a mortician who drives a refrigerated truck, and he has been credibly established as having assisted with the faking of some of these alleged atrocities by planting corpses. And apparently he's been doing this for a long time.
Well, this goes back to 1996 during Operation Grapes of Wrath. The Israelis accidentally dropped artillery shells in the same city, Kana, and the same guy, we call him Mr. Green Helmet,
mm-hmm.
was photographed back in 1996 carrying a dead Lebanese child, holding it up in supplication to the cameras. Same guy shows up 10 years later in Kana holding the baby in the same position. Boy, this looks like a trained propagandist who came out to do the same thing and it staged an event. This thing stinks to high heaven. And there's example after example where one of the photographers at Kana has faked his photos. He had a photo of Beirut with a little tiny wisp of smoke. It wasn't dramatic enough, so he pasted in giant billowing clouds of black smoke. There was another photo where a fighter plane, an Israeli fighter, was shooting rockets. And it was so they just pasted stuff into the pictures. He's altered the photos. The stuff you have seen coming out of the Reuters photography stuff is so false that Reuters went back and took 2,000 photos this guy has admitted in the last 20 years. And just banned them, took them all off the website.
Well, the first thing that put me on to this was photographs and also some footage of what purported to be Lebanese ambulances that were deliberately attacked by the Israelis. What is your comment on that?
Oh, there's so many of these phony ambulance things. One of my favorite ones is the ambulance worker. There was a recent series of photos taken, by the way, by the same guy from Reuters who was banned for the later photos, and he had photos of a bridge being knocked down. He had this so-called civil defense worker running across the bridge just before it was bombed and helping to dig people out of the rubble. Then another photo, you see the guy playing dead. I mean, he's literally laying down in the rubble, and his little green baseball cap is tucked neatly under his arm. It's a fraud. One of the cars in the background with three big shell holes in it is dragged around and posed in different sites. This stuff didn't happen.
One of the things that struck me about the ambulances is that the, supposedly these, and the, there were amen choruses in Australia, and particularly in Britain, talking about how this was proof of the Israelis committing war crimes. The ambulances, quite obviously, were not struck by high explosive aerial munitions. They'd be devastated. And one of them, there's a big hole right smack dab in the middle of the roof, probably where the light was. If that, there's no way that a round would have entered from that angle. And if it had, it would have completely devastated, around that size, we're talking 200-300 millimeters, would have devastated the vehicle and left a crater underneath.
Absolutely.
But this stuff is completely...
The ambulance prop is a very important prop because of its, you know, historic significance to Western peoples about, oh, they're rescuing injured people.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, there was one cable commentator, I forget who it was, but God bless him. He's sitting there with all these ambulances going by in the background, sirens screaming, going, I have to tell you, he said, this is a fraud. There were no strikes by Israel here today in this Arab town. No one is wounded. These ambulances are driving around the block in a continuous circle to make noise for our TV broadcast alone.
I know Brent Sadler of CNN has had some commentary. He's been one of the few to pierce the veil. And it, as much as this sticks in my craw, because I despise the guy, frankly, Rush, even Rush Limbaugh has been willing to cover.
He's a waste of valuable oxygen.
Oh, well, he is. I'm proud to say I was attacked by name by Rush Limbaugh on his nationally syndicated show in 1995.
Oh, I was attacked by him this year.
Yeah, well, good for you. You know, that's a great thing. The best comment about Rush Limbaugh...
It's one of my nine villages, right?
Well, it's one of your nine villages, and I've forgotten who it was offhand, but somebody was commenting about Rush Limbaugh, and they were comparing him with the Hindenburg, but they concluded that it was absolutely wrong to compare a flaming Nazi gas bag with a magnificent airship. So,
now, to be fair,
yep.
Rush didn't complete his high school classes, okay? He's not the brightest bulb on the face of the earth. And, you know, leaving aside his addiction to narcotics and all that stuff, he is a guy that has found his niche in the world. A bunch of, you know, really respectable guys sat him down and said, wait a minute, in order to be a journalist, you have to meet minimal standards of truth, of objectivity, of accuracy, of fairness. And Rush Limbaugh said, no, I don't. And he told them, he admitted this to them, said, I'm not a journalist, I'm an entertainer.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and that's what Rush Limbaugh is. So anyone thinks that getting news from Limbaugh is just screwy.
Yep, and I think it says a lot though about the imbalanced coverage that an awful lot of the mainstream media and the barking dogs who've begun to talk on the so-called progressive sector that they're not covering the fact that a lot of the coverage of alleged Israeli atrocities is verifiably false.
Oh, and even when it's proven to be false, a lot of the alternative media just won't report the story, and so the lie survives. It's horrible. I think I know a lot of Israeli officers. I like the Israelis. I think they're probably one of the few armies in the world that really means it about trying to have ethical and humane values in fighting. And I get emails from people saying, "But wait a minute, the Israelis are bombing civilians. Isn't that a war crime?" No. Otherwise, Winston Churchill would have been a war criminal and Roosevelt, because they bombed civilian cities all the time. The thing is that they bombed military targets inside civilian cities. That's different. What the Hezbollah is doing is bombing civilian areas with no military targets whatsoever in Israel. Those little villages in the north of Israel, they're not arms factories. They're just little farming villages. They're killing civilians deliberately. That's the war crime.
Mm-hmm.
That's the war crime.
John, there was a very famous incident, and again, if you think that perhaps I'm stretching an historical analogy here, feel free to comment critically, but there was the incident that kicked off World War II in Europe was an incident at Gliwice. It was called Operation Tannenberg,
the phony Polish soldiers that attacked Germany. Yeah.
Yeah. The head of the Gestapo, Heinrich Müller, and Reinhard Heydrich, took concentration camp inmates and dressed some up in German uniforms and some up in Polish uniforms and killed them and claimed it had been an attack at the Gliwice border station. Used this as a pretext for invading Poland. Do you think it's a stretch to perhaps see some of what's going on in Lebanon now as in effect an Operation Tannenberg?
Interesting question. I think that Iran is using its Hezbollah proxy in Lebanon as a means to test Western resolve.
Mm-hmm.
This whole thing blew up because Iran has no more good answers to give to the UN inspectors who are probing. And some of these UN inspectors are so good that Iran has called up the UN and said, don't ever let this guy in our country again. The real good guys, the experts, have been banned.
Mm-hmm.
Iran is absolutely trying to put together a factory to build mass assembled atomic weapons.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's what the UN inspectors have concluded. The guy that was banned from coming back to Iran, that's what he believes. There are no more good explanations on how you could find all this lab equipment with plutonium traces on it, or all these boxes with highly enriched uranium on it, stuff that's like 97%, enough to make a bomb. Iran has lied to everyone for too long. But, you know, China buys one every 7 barrels of Iranian oil. The Russians want to sell Iran 18 nuclear reactors. It's greed, short-term greed.
It was interesting that I believe it was July 12th on which the hostilities were kicked off with the killing and kidnapping of some Israeli soldiers. Wasn't that a key date vis-a-vis UN negotiations with Iran? On their budding nuclear capability?
Exactly. This whole thing is designed. August 22nd is the final date for Iran to respond. What we're looking at is it's a 30-day period where Iran has caused as much bloodshed as possible, A, to distract attention from Iran's major violations, and B, to send the subtle message that if you really want peace in the Middle East, you've got to leave Iran alone. All right?
Mm-hmm.
And the countries like China and Russia say, yeah, what the hell? Everybody's going to get nuclear weapons anyway. We might as well sell them to them. Somebody's going to sell them to them. And sadly, that mentality has been winning for a while. We have to stop it. No sane adult who is cognizant of the facts of Ahmadinejad's behavior in the history of Iran can say, we cannot allow this Hitler to have nukes. If we do that, no one is safe. Our children aren't safe. Our society isn't safe. You know, people think about all the losses in the war on terror. If you let Iran have nukes, we could lose the war on terror. Because he will give them to Al Qaeda. I mean, he's got Osama bin Laden's son was living in Iran. They admitted that last week.
Mm-hmm.
Iran is the last rogue state that really funds terrorism, and they fund. The Sunnis that kill the Shias in Iraq, even though they themselves are Shias. They fund the Shias in Lebanon to kill the Sunnis. This is a group that just destabilizes things. Iran needs another 3 years to perfect a warehouse of nuclear weapons to the point where it can dictate all policy in the Middle East. Or close down the Straits of Hormuz and shut off 40% of the world's oil supplies.
Mm-hmm.
Another good reason for finding alternative sources of energy.
Indeed. John, one of the things that's been striking and in light of your comments in this broadcast, somewhat puzzling to me, and that is the commentary of the Arab nations. Now, initially, many of them were critical of Hezbollah. Now, recently, they've sort of turned to a frankly fairly strident condemnation of Israel. Do you think that is a result of the disinformation that's been disseminated? Or do you think that this is in keeping, and I don't want to be misunderstood as being chauvinist or racist here, but in Arab culture, which is different than ours, the concept of saving face often governs official pronunciations in a way that a lot of Westerners don't understand. What's your take on that?
I guess I'm somewhere in between. I think what you're having here is that a deal has been struck, that we will give the Arab leadership permission to slap their gums around in public and attack us, Israel and America and Britain. But the reality is, the deal cut in private is that it's a lot of lip service. That they'll make a lot of noise, but no one in the Arab states will lift a finger to help Hezbollah. They are all delighted to see Hezbollah get crushed by Israel. And so Israel will have as much time and as much space as it needs to finish the job.
Really? So you don't, because now tomorrow, as we're speaking on Sunday, August 13th, I believe it's 5 o'clock or 7 o'clock tomorrow morning is the official deadline.
Yeah, I think there's a snowball's chance in hell that Hezbollah will obey it. Because the terms of this proposed peace treaty, when you read between the lines, are that Hezbollah has to withdraw from South Lebanon. Hezbollah has to disarm, and there can be no future resupply from Iran or Syria. All three of those things are terms which Hezbollah has previously rejected. I doubt very much if Nasrallah is going to go along with these terms that effectively say the Israelis won. They kicked Hezbollah out of southern Lebanon, when Hezbollah's whole claim to fate was they kicked Israel out of southern Lebanon. Complete fraud. The Israelis were withdrawing anyway, and Hezbollah rushed in and claimed the credit. I think that Hezbollah will never, ever go along with this peace deal, and that you're going to see Hezbollah start violation after violation. The Israelis will continue fighting, and in about 30 days, the last Hezbollah soldier will be dead in southern Lebanon, 30 to 60 days. At that point, that's when it will be safe for the Lebanese army and the UNIFIL force to come back in.
So you feel that it's very likely that the combat will continue, and that tacitly a number of the Arab nations, their official pronouncements to the contrary, to the exact opposite notwithstanding, are actually glad that the potential of a Shia-Iranian hegemony in the Middle East will be counteracted.
I think that's exactly what's going on. That Iran once regarded Lebanon in the 7th century as one of its provinces. And the Sunnis, particularly the Saudis, are terribly afraid that if Iran seizes southern Lebanon, and the, remember, the eastern provinces of Saudi Arabia are Shia.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where all the Saudi oil is. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
The Saudis are actually very, very vulnerable to a Shia insurrection.
Mm-hmm.
The Saudis are so upset that the King Abdullah of Saudi Arabia went to see the Turkish leaders last week, saying, "Hey, look, we got to join forces. You know, appease the right wing guys, and you know, all collaborate together." And the Turks, to their credit, said, "No, not going to happen."
So basically, the Turkish army has traditionally been a secular force, and brutally so. They don't tolerate Islamism.
No, and their prime minister, ironically, is an elected Muslim. He is Erdogan is the Muslim activist.
Yep.
So Erdogan has pushed it to the point of no return. The army apparently told him this week, this far, no further, or we will remove you, and it's over.
So basically, the Turkish army has laid down the law to Erdogan.
That's what I'm hearing.
And alrighty, and he in turn had rejected some appeals by King Abdullah to generate Islamic reaction.
Yep.
Alrighty. Well, John, we're all out of time. Very quickly, the websites, for your websites.
IntelligenceSummit.org is my favorite project. www.intelligencesummit.org. There's a lot of interesting news things there. Pay particular attention to Harold's list. I can't tell you who Harold is, but he's a very senior intelligence figure. My private website is johnloftus.com, john-loftus.com. And a new pet project, just a buddy of mine has just started this up in the last couple of weeks, the terrorfreeoil.com.
All righty, and I also want to encourage listeners to pay attention to the Spitfire website with the many links, including a dozen or so old anti-fascist books from the World War II and pre-World War II period, talking about some of the dynamics we've spoken about here. We have been visiting with John Loftus, the author, among other titles, The Ballara Secret, Secret War Against the Jews and Unholy Trinity. And this wraps up For the Record program number 564, interview with John Loftus, subtitled He Who Tells the Truth Gets Chased Out of Nine Villages. For John Loftus, this is Dave Emery saying thanks for listening.